listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flueckiger, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the show this afternoon or this evening, wherever you're at. Your Ultimate Life, the show dedicated to one thing only, and that's to help you create a life of purpose, prosperity, and joy by serving with your gifts, talents, and having a great time doing it. I'm grateful I got a special guest tonight, Andrea Sampson, who's joining me here. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kellen. I'm really excited to be here with you.
Well, I'm grateful to have you here. So I didn't do an intro, and I don't. And the reason is because it's fun for me to have the guest unveiled as we go through the show and let people get to know you in layers, you know, and they give that big long intro. Nobody listens anyway. So why don't you start by telling me and the guests, our audience here, I know a little about you because we've spoken before, but tell me what's on your heart. Tell me how Andrea shows up in the world. How do you add good to the world?
Oh, what a fabulous question. You know, adding good to the world is actually one of the most important things to me. I grew up, I think, in a family, you know, in a small town in Nova Scotia, and I grew up with community around me. And so for me, you know, helping people out, doing the right thing, recognizing kindness and being kind, these were things that were incredibly important to me. And as I aged and as I grew, you know, grew into my career and went out into the big wide world, I started to see that it wasn't something that everybody cared about. And it made me sad, quite frankly. And so when I opened my business and decided that I was going to do the thing that I wanted to do and not what everybody else wanted me to do, I built a business built on doing good in the world and helping others find their purpose. And it has been probably one of my most, the most rewarding thing I've done, and also the thing I'm most proud of in my life, you know, helping others to find their voice, find their passion, you know, find their heart and show it no matter where they are or what they're doing. And I think, I learned that I have a gift in doing that. And so it's been incredibly powerful.
Why do you think, so it's not unusual for me to interview guests and have them say something about having a desire to help and serve others in some way. And that's the whole point of how you're adding good into the world. Why do you think it is so hard, so unusual or so difficult, so that people need help to find their passion or their heart or all that good stuff that I talk about too? But I want to know why you think we live in a place where everybody's hidden, everybody's afraid, and everybody is, you know, mostly everybody. Why is that so?
You know, I don't know that it's that everybody is hidden or afraid. I think what it is that we need each other. And you know, one of the things I learned, I like to study lots of different systems of getting to know oneself. And one of the systems that I recently, in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, ran into is something called human design. And one of the things I love about human design is it's got these ways in which that we connect with others, and what's called gates. And it really opened my eyes to this idea that, you know, I come into this world with whatever gifts are given to me. You come into this world with whatever gifts are given to you. Some of those gifts are really apparent. We find them early on in life. Some we have to dig a little deeper. And some we know we have, but we have a difficulty accessing them. And it's interesting at how when we meet each other and suddenly we have access to parts of ourselves that we never had access to before. And I think that that's actually what happens is we think sometimes that we're really disconnected, that we're, you know, we don't need everyone. But in reality, we need others, not just because it's a nice feeling to have somebody else in our lives, but also because it helps us to access parts of ourselves that we didn't know we had or that we couldn't access by ourselves.
That's really interesting. And that, you know, the complementary nature of our existence. So that means like a jigsaw, you can, when you're connected with other people in the right way that have the right sort of tentacles and connections, you get a more beautiful, more powerful, more capable, more joyful picture. I want to dig in a little deeper on this question, though, because so often people express this feeling of they have a yearning, and they may suspect or know that they have certain gifts or even, you know, a purpose. Yet they have this fear, or they're afraid of, or they doubt it, or they think it's less than, or, you know, some version of negative language. Mm. How do we live in a world like, what's wrong that we live in this place or time that seems to have a blanket on that kind of thing? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that, well, I mean, I think there's many answers to that. And I guess if I look at this moment in time, you know, here we are in 2025, a world that is filled with access to tools that have given us both amplification and a mirror on ourselves and a mirror on the world around us. Social media, you know, I mean, you and I are speaking on social media channels. And never before in our existence has it been so easy to get access to the world. And I think when we think about it in that terms, we've never, ever been able to see ourselves in the context of the whole ever. And it's intimidating, for to say the least. Suddenly we have people who are so comfortable in these mediums and seem to live lives that are far beyond what we could ever imagine. And then and we look at ourselves and go, well, why them and not me? Or we see people with gifts that seem so far superior to us, and, you know, and we look at them and go, why them and not me? And so it's easy to do the comparison game and then to have the imposter syndrome that goes along with comparing. And I think one of the lessons that we're learning as a humanity right now is that this is not about anyone else. We have everything we need right here in this body, in this experience, in this moment. And when we understand that, we can go beyond it. But it's hard to get there. It is really hard to get there in a world where every time we pick up a phone, you know, our phones, or we turn on the TV, or we look at our computer, we have the opportunity to compare ourselves to somebody who maybe looks just like us, maybe sounds just like us, but isn't us. And we go, why not that? Why them and not me?
So you said, I agree, and we do that comparison thing is can be at least really poison and really sort of a barrier or a set of chains that hold people, you, me, any of us, down, because we look at that and we see somebody else and go, ooh, I'm not that, whatever that is. So you said you grew up with this supportive environment, and then you got out in the world and saw that, gee, it's not really that way. So what happened? Tell me a little bit about the journey. You saw that and that the world was different, about how you navigated that to get back to a place of creating and, you know, leaning into that kind of supportive nature. Tell me a little bit about how that happened.
You know, I mean, I grew up, like I said, in Nova Scotia. Actually, my family are from Cape Breton, which is a small island off the coast of Cape Breton, or off the coast of Nova Scotia in Canada. And, you know, when you're in small communities, now I grew up in a larger city, but I spent most of my childhood, you know, summers in this small community. And I was literally related to everyone. You know, like, it's a small community. And, you know, my father's had, you know, there were 13 kids in his family. There were 9 in my mother's. Everyone seemed to be, you know, my cousin. And so it was, you know, one of those environments where, like, you just, like, whether you liked them or not, you were related to them. So we all supported each other. And I didn't always like all of them, but, you know, we cared about each other. And when I left Nova Scotia, you know, when I left young, I grew up and kind of went out on my own. And when I came to Toronto, I was 23 when I moved to Toronto, and I didn't know anyone. I literally had, I knew one person in Toronto. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a place to live. And, you know, the universe provides, I always like to say, you know, create a void and the universe will fill it. And so I found places to live and to work and do all of those things, and I survived. But what I learned is, you come to a big city, and for, you know, first of all, you don't know everyone. You know, even in the small city that I lived in Nova Scotia, I knew enough people that I could always go somewhere and I always knew someone. And here I am in this big city, and people were not like me. They didn't sound like me. They didn't look like me. And I didn't know how to relate to them. And it took me a very long time to be able to start to understand that the way I had grown up was not the way most of those people had grown up. And so I had to find those points of connection that weren't so obvious and that weren't just a given. And I think that is the key was for me. It was learning that, okay, I need to figure out who I am. And in figuring out who I am, then I can find how I can connect with others. And it did take me a long time. I would say it was probably 5 years before I really could say I had friends in Toronto. And, you know, even though I had found my, you know, I found my place and found a career and was doing all of the good things, but really the connection was not there. And I think big cities tend to be isolating for so many reasons. Like, you know, it was funny because like I remember also being talking to people, and I think of one in every 10 person I talked to was actually from Toronto. Everybody was, you know, an import to the city. Now, many of them were Canadian, but many of them weren't. And so we all had these like really different backgrounds and values and expectations and cultures. And so the connection points have to be more intentional, because when you are with people that you know, it just happens. You know, you've got a default connection point, but that's not always the case.
You know, one of the things you said just now, and that when you're talking about that 5 years, you said the first thing you had to do was learn who you were. Mm-hmm. And it made me wonder, do you think most people know who they are?
No, I think it's probably one of the most underrated activities in our culture. I think people are afraid of getting to know who they are. I think there's a fear that they, again, it comes back to your question earlier of the less than, you know, if I really know who I am, maybe I'll find out that I'm not as good as I think I am. And, you know, when we can let go of that judgment, I mean, my God, what a difference in our lives it makes, right? When we stop judging ourselves by the context of others, when we stop judging ourselves by what we have or who we are or what we believe to be important, and we just sit still in the moment and recognize that really all we need is this beautiful human spirit that we have. And that's enough. That's enough.
So I love that. And we're going to get to some of the things that you've learned and that you do now in a bit. But is part of the work that you do helping people learn who they are? Because you said, and I agree with you, that I don't think people do. I don't think they take time enough to figure that out. And maybe they're afraid of it, like you said. And so what do you do with that when you're running into people and you can tell they may pretend whatever, but you can tell they actually don't know who they are. And maybe they're afraid of it. Maybe they're not. But it's clear they don't know.
Yeah. And so I help people speak, right? Like I'm a speaker's coach. Mm-hmm. And so I work with, and I work almost exclusively with people who are either in very high level leadership roles or scientists or academics or technologists. I work with people with very complex messaging who have very big roles in the world. And it's so interesting to me, you know, I've worked with literally thousands of people over the course of the work that I do. And every time I have a new client come in, you know, the very first thing I always do is get to know them. Who are you? Tell me about yourself. And that question throws people, or I find that they are in that place of, you know, they give me their resume, you know, I've done this, I've done that. And it's like, but no, who are you? And so even though my role is to help them find their voice, like often we're doing everything from executive presence to building out talks to creating core messaging and all of the things that you do in a communications role. But ultimately, what I'm really doing underneath all of that is I'm reuniting them with themselves, because my role is not just to help them find that message, but to reflect back to them as a mirror who they are and how I see them. And it, you know, so many times, I remember I was working with a client recently, and I reflected something back to her, and she looked at me and she goes, I don't believe you. And I was a bit taken back. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, oh, you're just trying to make me feel good. And I said to her, I was really quite shocked. And I said, wow, first of all, I would never do that. I don't do that with my clients. That's not my role. But more importantly, I just told you, you did a great job. Like that was the way you said that, the message, that was really good. And it took her a few minutes to really accept that she was actually good at something and that I wasn't just trying to stroke her ego. And, it made me really think about, what kind of a life has she lived that's where she is now. That even a simple compliment from somebody whose job it is to tell the truth, would feel like a lie.
That's a very, very interesting observation. I was on a coaching call with a client I had this morning, and one of the things, he's been a client for many years, and over the years, one of the things that has been evident in not only him, but in partnership and business he's running and stuff like that is some of the same things you're talking about, and that's sort of an outflow of what we were talking about earlier, about people don't know themselves, they're afraid to, they don't believe in it. And even when, they do well and someone reflects that, it's like, I don't believe you. What do you want? Are you stroking me in some way? And that was a reflection of that in terms of what she said to you. So what did you do? We're going to get to your speaker coaching and presence and all that. I love that stuff in a minute. What did you do before that? So you got to Toronto and you're doing stuff and you found a career. What was the path to get you to where you really decided that your mission is to help people connect with, understand, project, present, and find their voice?
Yeah, a long journey. When I arrived in Toronto, I originally came here to go to school. And, the way in which I arrived was pretty fast. I made the decision that I was going to school in Halifax and kind of decided one day that I could go to school and bartend anywhere because that's what I was doing. And right. I thought, okay, where am I going to go? So I applied to a bunch of schools, got accepted everywhere, which really wasn't helpful, and then made the decision to go to Toronto because it felt like, well, it's not so far away that I couldn't, go back if I needed to. And so I literally, I made the decision that I was going to move in July, packed my car, sold it on the way to Toronto, and arrived in Toronto with all my earthly goods and no job, no place to live, and figured it out. And no car.
Right. You sold your car. Okay.
Yep. And so there I was in Toronto, and I was ready to go to University of Toronto. And it didn't quite work out that way. I ended up getting a job and went, all right, well, I guess I'm not going back to school right now. I'll go back at another time. So I got a job, actually. I had gone to a recruitment agency to see if I could get a summer job or whatever, and they ended up hiring me, and I became a headhunter, which was really not something I ever thought I would do, and didn't last very long, but I did learn sales. And I ended up from there in the not-for-profit world, and I was a fundraiser. I trained as a fundraiser, went to school for fundraising, spent that first part of my career doing fundraising and loved it. Felt like I was doing good things in the world. I was not making a whole lot of money, but I was, raising money for things that I really cared about. I worked in health charities and in children's charities, and it felt good. And I got to a point where I realized that, everything I've ever taken on, I always progress very quickly. And so I was, 5 years in, and I had sort of gotten to the point where I was like either going to run in the charity or I had to move on. And I started to understand a little bit about charities, about the politics of it. Because, my bosses were volunteers for the most part. They were board members, but they were all volunteers, and it was highly political. And I made a decision I needed to leave. Like, as much as I loved doing the work that I was doing inside of the charities was highly political, and I was not a political person, and I needed to leave. And so I ended up moving into the service industry, and I had a very hard time leaving charities because in those days, and this was many years ago, every time I would interview, they'd look at my resume and they'd say, well, you've got no experience. You've just been volunteering. I was like, no, I was actually staff and I was paid. And, but they wouldn't see it as experience. And so I ended up having to go into the service industry. And I worked in contract call centers as an account manager. And this was like, it was, my career path has been so interesting because I always sort of landed somewhere just at a moment when the world was changing. And so I ended up landing into contract call centers around the time that we saw long distance and energy in a deregulated state. So we were going through deregulation. And call centers were integral at that moment because they were doing inbound and outbound. And so, and technology was just becoming something. And we were using technology in a way, and I learned how to actually how to work with databases and how to code and how to write specs to write software. And these were things that I wasn't trained in, but I had to do. And I spent a couple of years doing that. To be honest, really hated that work, but I knew that I had to do it to kind of move somewhere else. And the somewhere else, while I was doing that work, I was going to school in the evening, learning about advertising, never thinking I was going to be able to get into advertising. And 2 years in, I ended up having my daughter. And while I was on mat leave, I ended up getting recruited into advertising and spent the next 20 years working for very large ad agencies, working for some of the largest agency networks in the world on some of the world's most recognizable brands. And I started off in the client side. So I was client service. And then eventually moved into strategy and planning. And, you know, that idealist in me that was the fundraiser, that loved being that, doing good work, never left me. I always wanted to do that. And when I went into the ad world, you know, having spent that first part of my career in not-for-profit, suddenly I find myself working with these brands with, you know, millions and millions of dollars to spend in advertising. And I just remember being blown away by that and thinking, okay, you know, here's my chance. I can make a little bit of a dent in the universe here by maybe doing some good with that money. And, you know, look, advertising is selling. I wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that naive, but what I thought is like, well, maybe what I can do is sway the message so that the message is, you know, more inclusive or, you know, touching on big issues. And I did. And for 20 years, I did that work. And I was really proud of the work that I did. But there came a point where I finally had to admit to myself, I was an idealist in a capitalist world. And it was time for me to change. And that was the moment, you know, and I remember it. I was, you know, probably in my mid 40s, I think. And I remember thinking to myself, this can't be all there is. And I knew I wanted to leave, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I started going to conferences and like doing a lot of personal development work. Mm-hmm. I was doing spirituality, like touching on that as well. And doing volunteer work. And around that time, I had the good fortune to be volun hired by a TED brand, TEDx Toronto. And mm-hmm. at the time, this was in the early, early days of TEDx. Like TEDx Toronto was actually had license number 2. Oh, and wow. I got involved with them probably 3 years after the launch of the TEDx brand. And it was such a revelation for me. You know, I was volun hired as a speaker's coach. I didn't even know what a speaker's coach was. Had never heard of it. But I was at the time, I was a senior vice president of strategy for a very large agency. My whole job was about presenting. That's what I did every day, all day. And, you know, because I was in strategy, we were doing research. I was doing, you know, distillations of large swatches of information. And as I found myself in the TED world, working with these incredible change makers who were so busy doing the work, they were forgetting to tell anyone about it. I found myself with this skill that I didn't know I had, which was being able to take their life's work and turn it into one idea. And that's how I got started.
So I love that. The distillation, that's such an important skill in my mind. The idea that, because things are complicated. I mean, you know, I was on a call earlier today where someone was explaining some very complex things. And in 3 minutes, you know, they were way over everybody's head. And so, and there's tons of subjects like that. It doesn't matter which one today was. And there's so many. It's in technology and banking and finance and how money works and just all kinds of things. And the ability that you've just described to take a difficult or complex thing and I won't say dumb it down, but organize it in such a way that it becomes accessible to other people is really powerful. So tell me what, so you got into the TEDx world and that's where you became a speaker coach. Tell me how that developed, because that's all you do now. Is that right?
That's right. So what happened was, so I come into the TEDx world and I find myself in this world that, you know, I'm kind of blown away by. You know, I had been a fan of TED for years. TEDx, like I said, was fairly new, but of course we'd all been watching TED on videos. And I find myself as a speaker's coach. What I didn't realize was I was actually part of the curation team. And so I wasn't just coaching speakers, I had to find them. And so that was a whole other thing. But I find myself there. I realize I have this skill that I didn't know I had. And I love it. It's giving me such, like, it's speaking to my heart. I'm seeing these individuals who, like I said, are doing such good work in the world. And I think the thing that really, really struck me about TED was that, and especially the people that I was working with, you know, every person that we would, like, as part of the curation team, we had to find the 12 or 13 people we would put on stage. Well, we would get about 1,000 applications to get it down to the 12 or 13. And so you'd read all of these applications. Like, we read every one of them. We had to choose. And, you know, I started to realize, you know, how much I didn't know about what was happening in our world. You know, I worked in advertising. I had to know a lot about a lot. And here I am, you know, finding out about things that I'm like, why did I not know this? Why is this not common knowledge? And, you know, then I would meet the people doing this work and realize, like, this isn't just one, there's many people doing this. And so I started to change my view of the world. Like, you know, I lived in a world, and many of us do, where we're being fed so much information that was telling us that the world's going to hell in a handbasket. And I suddenly saw a different world. And I thought to myself, this is a world that I want others to see. It's not fair that we don't get to see this. And it, more than not fair, it's actually not, it's so important that we see that there is good work happening in the world and that we can have hope. Because so much of our media is about taking hope away from us. And for the first time, when I started working in the TED world, I saw hope being given back to us. And so I spent about 5 years working with
TED. I'm going to stop you there. I want you to go there. But yep. I want to contrast a couple things. You said in advertising, you'd done that for a bunch of years, and you realized I'm an idealist in a capitalist world, and you were not happy, and you had to move on. And now you've expressed, I found it. I went to this place, and not only doesn't the world suck, it's actually hopeful and good. Tell me the difference in just a daily thing, like when you get up in the morning, going to the advertising world where you're going to do this stuff that you have to grit your teeth and get through, compared to now being in a place where not only have you found a gift that you have to help people do this, but it is a hope-filled enterprise. Tell me the difference in you when you look at those two things.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? Because I was still working in advertising. Because this was volunteer work, right? So okay. I was still getting up every morning and going to my job, and I hated it, you know, like, it was drudgery. But then I would have these, like, especially that, like, that first year was such a big, like, eye-opening thing. Like, I really didn't know whether I could do this thing called speaker coaching. And I remember we ran the event and I was just like, wow, how do we do that again? How do we do that again? You know? And so the next year I put my hand up again, volunteered again, and I knew what to expect. And my day job was really difficult, like I said. And I ended up leaving. At the time I was working for an agency, I left that agency. I went and I started doing consulting. So I started to kind of pull away because I knew how unhappy I was. But, you know, it's really hard to change your career when you've been in it for 20 years and you make good money and you've got good, you know, like I was very well known in the industry and, you know, in demand and all of those things. So feeding an ego that, you know, and a lifestyle. And suddenly I'm like, well, okay, how would I make that shift? And in this, I think it was either the second or the third year of work. It must've been the second year of working. Yeah. The second year of working on TED, I had a personal tragedy, my sister-in-law. So, my brother, got married, that summer. And a week after they got married, he and my sister-in-law were involved in a motorcycle accident and she died. And I went from going to their wedding to 2 weeks later, taking my brother to her funeral. It's a surreal experience to see that kind of like life event, right? The happiest day of their lives. Right. And then to literally see her wedding picture at her funeral, like that we had just all been to. And, you know, you realize life is not guaranteed. And I think we all know that, but
not let you know it when something like that happens.
Yeah, it's really quite, you know, impactful. And I think, you know, there are these little, we get these pokes in life. And I realized that life was too short for me to just keep doing this thing. I hate it. And I didn't know that I was going to be a speaker's coach. Like at that point, like this was the second year and I still loved it and all of those things. The third year, I took a sabbatical. So I literally was like, okay, that was, you know, my sister-in-law had died and I relooked at my life. And I remember waking up one morning in this lovely little house that I had in the suburbs and my daughter was off to university and I was sitting meditating because it's something that I've done for years every morning. And I'm looking around at this lovely little house and going, why do I live here? What am I doing here? This is not making me happy. And I put my house on the market. I sold it. I took a sabbatical from all work. And I had to decide what my life was going to look like. And I always like to say, you know, when the money ran out, because it does. I was like,
yeah, okay, it does. I was going to ask. So you decided you had to figure it out. And how did that work?
So I, you know, I did a bunch of things. I bought a condo. I renovated. I traveled through Europe. I did a bunch of things. And then, you know, and all through that, at that point, I was the director of curation for TEDx Toronto. So I was still doing that. And I was doing all these other things. And we were coming up on the conference and I was like realizing I was going to have to figure what the heck I was going to do to make money. And I was sitting one night with a couple of the other speakers coaches who I had brought on board and trained. And I was talking about that. I was like, I don't know what the heck I'm going to do because I don't want to go back into advertising. I don't want to do marketing. And one of them looked at me and they said, well, why don't you do this? And I looked at them and I went, no one would ever pay me for this. This isn't a real job. And they said, yeah, it is. And they will. And you're really good at it. You should think about that. And I was like, I kind of scratched my head. I really truthfully had not even occurred to me that this was an actual job. I thought it was made up. And so I kind of went away and I ended up talking to that same speaker's coach. And we ended up talking a lot. And we ended up opening probably 4 months later, we opened Talk Boutique together, which is my company. And we went into a partnership together. And you know, I said, okay, well, we'll give it 6 months and let's see. And it took about 6 months. But it was incredible to see that this was something that was needed. And it was needed because, you know, not just because it's, you know, it is a good thing to do, but this expertise of working with really complex messages and that idea, because like, as I thought about it and as I developed what became Talk Boutique, because it was my idea, like as I thought about it, I was like, well, I want to work with people who are purpose-driven, who are doing good work in the world. And I want to work with scientists and academics and technologists the way that I was doing that, and even artists. But the problem with all of those people is, A, they are really complex. No one understands what the heck they're saying. They don't have any of the pieces that they need in order to be a recognized speaker. And they need help. And so, okay, well, what if we open a speakers bureau along with a coaching consultancy and put these things together, and we help those people, the people who are really doing the good work in the world? And that was how I got to the place of saying, yes, I will do that. I will do that in service of creating a future that is reflective of all the people who are living in it, because that's why I want to do it. It's about changing the social narrative so we can go from negative to positive, so we can co-create a future together. And so that was the early impetus of talking.
There are three things. I know I'm interrupting you, but I want to, things. One, you said helping people learn to speak who haven't practiced that because they're busy doing other stuff. Two, a speakers bureau, which is, okay, now that we're teaching you how to speak, let's find you some places to speak. And the third thing is sort of the basket is, I want to do this with people that are doing good and making a difference. And that's okay. It's really important, because that's three different pieces. Learn to speak, and then find an outlet, places to go speak. And we're going to really focus on people that are doing stuff that makes a difference, not just people that are trying to sell a bunch of stuff and do whatever, but focusing on those whose work is purpose-driven and trying to add good to the world in its own right. So tell me about the development of both your method for helping people and how your business grew.
So the method came early because I had developed it in TED. And so one of the things that I had done in my work with TED is I had developed an entire training process for speakers. And we had developed, I had frameworks and process for doing that. So I had this process that, you know, it was, I mean, it's much more developed now, but in those days we had something to start with. Mm-hmm. And so that was the easy part. Moving into working with, like, getting people to come and find us, that was harder. The bureau side of it, like, for me, it was really important, because it's not enough to have a message. You've got to be able to convey that message. Right. And that was really key. So those early days were, a lot of it was in developing what we stood for. And, you know, one of the things we came on early on are, it's changed, and I no longer have a business partner. That's a whole other story. But in those early days, we had decided that our tagline was creating intelligent conversations. And that was also a key to it, because conversations change our world.
Yeah,
and
they
when
do.
when we have the right conversations, right? And so one of the biggest parts of Talk Boutique in those early days is we used to run these things called salons. And what a salon was a combination of speakers, and mostly TED speakers. We were working with the people that I had, you know, worked with on TED, and we would bring them in, and I would curate the speakers to a big unanswerable question. So I remember when we launched the company, we asked the question of, have we lost the art of conversation in favor of the practice of discussion? And then we curate two speakers to that, and let them, not a debate, just like they give the, you know, and the two speakers, I had one of the speakers, he was a big thinker. He had done many things. He's in the tech world, very articulate. And the other speaker was a hostage negotiator. And so each of them had their own perspective on it. And the evening was really about conversation. So we would inspire the audience with conversation, or with these talks, and then throw it to them and go, okay, now talk. And there's no right or wrong answer, but think about it. And so that really kind of propelled us, right? It got us into this place of thinking and conversing and being thoughtful and intentional in the way that we worked. And then along that same time, we got involved with Singularity University out of Silicon Valley. One of the volunteers, I was still working on TED at this point, at TEDx Toronto, still volunteering. And mm-hmm. one of our volunteers was a guy who had he was working for Deloitte, and he had gone down to Silicon Valley. He had been trained by Singularity University, came back, was like, we need to bring that to Canada. And we're like, great, we're in. And so there were four of us who got together. And as we were building Talk Boutique, we also brought the Singularity University brand to Canada and opened SU Canada. And through that, started to work with these deep technology experts all throughout the world. I eventually became the head of faculty for SU Canada and the lead certifier for Singularity globally, certifying their faculty all over the world. And that was a pivotal growth piece for Talk Boutique, because we were working in the corporate world with corporate leaders, training them how to do their presentations like TED speakers, which was helping these purpose-driven organizations be more effective. We were working with these experts and really starting to change the conversation, working with the Singularity brand, which at the time was really powerful in the world. And it was exciting. And so that, you know, we opened the company in 2016, and right through to 2020, we were growing like, you know, doubling every year. And then 2020 hit.
Right.
And that's a whole other world. And that was, you know, what you never know what the world is going to present to you. And, you know, 2019 was our most successful year as a business. And it was the most difficult year for me and my business partner. And, you know, one of the things that I learned was that when you're going to be in partnership with anyone, it's really important that your vision be the same. And not similar, but the same. And, you know, when my partner and I had first gotten together, we had sort of developed this vision, and there were some differences. And at the time I was like, you know, it's close enough. We're good. Well, when you put pressure on a partnership like that, when you're growing at that rate, when you've got the kinds of conversations that we were having and, you know, doing the work we were doing, those little differences, that became everything, and it became untenable. And I'd made the decision to end that partnership, which I did. I bought out my partner, and mm-hmm. I bought him out in March of 2020, 3 days before the world went into lockdown.
So I want you to, what a, you know, cliffhanging moment right there, 3 days before the lockdown. So we've got about 8 minutes, and what I want to do is we've got a cliffhanger there, and maybe we need to finish the story and maybe we don't. I'm going to leave that to you. What I want you to do is I want you to tell us what's going on now, how to find you, how to participate with you, how to follow you, all of those good things. And if you want to do it in the context of growing out of the catastrophe, fine. And if you want to do it just by leaving a gap there, that's fine too. So use all of your masterful training and continue moving so that we make sure we get that good stuff.
Of course. So, you know, as with any crisis, there is always, always learning that you get, you know, and I like to say the universe keeps, you know, nudging you. And if you don't pay attention, it'll eventually, you know, the nudging won't be quite so gentle. And I would say that that's what it was.
I know that. Those who have listened to my story know my 2x4s. But anyway, keep going.
And so, you know, that was a moment. And yes, it could have been, everything was over. But what was really going on for me was that was the universe pushing me to say, get up and use your voice. It's time to shift, you know. And that was one of the biggest things, was my ex-business partner loved to be the center of attention. He wanted to be the one center stage. And I didn't. I never wanted to be center stage. That was not who I was, except that's not true. I needed to be center stage. My message, my focus, my way of seeing the world was important. And so that's what had to happen. And over the past 5 years, that's exactly what's happened. I have stepped into my own thought leadership. I've shifted the business. We've moved into a place of much more focused on storytelling, on the power of story to create change in our world. You know, our tagline is now stories that sell. And I love coming from the place of selling is serving, you know, that selling is about us actually giving the world what it needs when it needs it. And so I talk a lot about the need for diversity of thought leadership. What I do now, yes, the business, essentially all the elements are the same, but why we do it, how we do it, what we do is completely different. I've formalized everything. I've become much more of an expert in thought leadership and building thought leaders, and really helping people to step into that. So today, we are still a coaching consultancy that focuses on developing the voice of those who are making a difference in our world. We do work with individuals and with corporate leaders. We work with purpose-driven organizations always. And we do the work from a place of true expertise and mastery. We still have our speakers bureau. It's not quite as active as it was pre-pandemic. It's the last piece of the puzzle that needs to come back. And we'll get there. We're building it now. And so if people want to, you know, check out what we do a lot of work. I do a ton of work on YouTube. Check out our YouTube channel at Talk Boutique. You'll see me. I'm there, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. We're putting up content, and I give a lot of our methodology away. I think it's important. Like, people should have access to this. You know, if you want to work with me, that's different. But I think you should have access to the knowledge we have because it's powerful. Using your voice is important. Saying what it is that you need to put out in the world is important. And it's important because when we think about thought, here's the thing that, and this came to me probably 3 or 4 years ago as I was learning about me and going, okay, I'm going to have to do this.
It's time for Andrea to be the thought leader.
Yes. And what I had to get to was the fact that thought leader, we think about thought leaders and we think, okay, well, those are like leaders of countries or leaders of industry or leaders of companies, right? And when I looked around, none of those people looked like me. And the problem with that is that those leaders, and you know, we see this today in a big way, are defining my future. But yet none of them look like me. None of them know what I know. So how am I being included in the future that's being created for me? So I can either accept what they're doing, or I can choose to step into my voice, to use my unique knowledge, my unique perspective, and add my voice as a thought leader. Now, I may not be a leader of a country or a company, but I am a leader within my circles. And because of that, I can create a ripple. And my ripple will affect somebody else's, and that will affect somebody else's. And I'm not alone. There are a lot of people out there who is not reflected in the thought leadership that is creating our future. So join in. Co-create that future, because what I want is a future that is co-created by all of those who are living within it. And so thought leadership is really, really important. And so I had to learn that, then I had to live it. I had to get over myself, and I had to show up fully owning what I know and who I am.
That's perfect. So let me make sure people know, if people want to follow you or connect or get on your list, or besides going to your YouTube channel of Talk Boutique, where do they need to do that?
Yeah. So talkboutique.com is our website. Sign up for our newsletter. We put it out twice a week or twice a month. You can also follow me on LinkedIn. I am very active on LinkedIn, Andrea Sampson. You'll look me up. You will definitely find me. So these are places where you will find our content. You will find, you can sign up and, you know, and reach out to me, you know, we've got a contact us form on our website. Feel free to reach out at any point, and we would be happy to connect with you and talk to you about how we can help you, or even if I can just mentor you a little bit, like I do that with so many people.
Andrea, I want to thank you. Your idea there of everybody needs to get their voice, trust their voice, make it known. We have both the technology and the reach to do that. Thanks for being here with me today.
Well, thank you, Kellen, for this incredible opportunity. I so appreciate you and the work that you're doing in the world.
I want all of you to hear what Andrea was talking about. She had to learn to trust her voice, to use it, and then to believe that it makes a difference. We've been talking about your ultimate life now for years on this show, and using your voice, trusting, identifying, owning your voice, and making it heard in a way to shape your own future, create the ripples that she talked about, and then participate in the creation of the world. That is truly the way to move forward, have joy, and create your ultimate life.
You're listening to Your Ultimate Life with Kellen Flukiger, only on LA Talk Radio.